human intelligence, espionage. I've been asked to talk about a couple of chunks of what is human intelligence. The story I'd like to tell is the business of the Tehran rescue mission, the abortive attempt to go in and rescue the hostages being held at the American Embassy in Tehran.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. For the purpose of introducing today's guest, I'm delighted to welcome a man who needs no introduction at all to this or any other audience around the world, the 62nd Secretary of State of the United States, Lawrence Eagleburger.
I will be quick because I've got to go back home as fast as I can to find out if I'm still solvent. I would suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that you take a hard look at this gentleman who's about to speak before you. You will not see his like again, and I regret that intensely. He is from the days of the Central Intelligence Agency when they did brilliant work, most of it never known, and where it was known, or has become known, usually it is some politician, starting with Senator Church some years ago, who drags them before some committee and beats them up on something that they did or shouldn't have done, or in other words, how they have been at best close to illegal in their activities. Well, I want to tell you something. During the bad old days with the Soviet Union, it is these people, as much as anyone, who knew what was going on there, knew how to predict it, not always rightly, but usually correctly, and most of the time when the Soviets were playing games with us, illicit games, spying, if you will, it is these people who were able to, one, identify it, two, give us an opportunity to end it. It was a nasty game sometimes, and it's the nastiness, I guess, that has led our more recent politicians to find that it was a terrible thing they did. But it is, in fact, what saved our bacon more than once, and this man particularly did more than his share, including practically losing his life in Tehran when some of the Iranian nasty types beat him up on the street, and he's never fully recovered from that physically, and he'll never say that to you. But I happen to know it for a fact, and that and so many other things that he did specifically make him, as far as I'm concerned, not only one of my best friends, but a real hero. So I would like to introduce to you my hero, and I hope yours. What is your name again, young fellow? Mr. Hart.
It's an honor for Larry Eagleburger to be here and introduce me. To say the very least. There's something else I'd like to say. I'm speaking from the heart. See, and I will get more of that as time goes on. There are precious few complimentary statements ever made about my former organization, CIA, which no longer exists. But when they come from someone like Larry Eagleburger, who has been, for many years, one of the most brilliant practitioners of the black arts of diplomacy. That's a terrific accolade, and on behalf of a whole lot of my colleagues, Larry, thank you very much.
You had this planned all along, folks. But
and a wonderful American, and I'd like you all to join me. We have a great American of a generation that fought for our lifetime and won. Larry Eagleburger. Thank you for him. Human intelligence. Human catchy phrase, espionage, comes in many manifestations, and one small part of CIA, which part I belong to, practiced that profession. And I've been asked to talk about a couple of chunks of what is human intelligence and what does it involve, et cetera. Well, you could write books about it. You could spend hours talking about it. So I've been asked to kind of personalize it, take a couple of incidents that happened in my career and in my life, and perhaps paint a bit of a picture in that. I've got to tell you right away that it's daunting, one, to be able to even try to do that. The second one is, I'm going to hate the use of the first person singular a lot because I'm telling a story as I saw it, so I'm going to have to pass that on to you. The first thing that I'm going to talk about, again, to give you a grasp of what is this thing called espionage, human intelligence, meaning on the ground, working with, against, for, in a covert manner, the best interests of this nation. First, I'm sure you are aware that everybody's in the intelligence business. If you read a newspaper, you're in the intelligence business. Espionage is the world's second oldest profession, flat out, because as soon as somebody had something that was knowledge or whatever it was, other people wanted to obtain it, and if you were trying to defend it, you had to resort to espionage to get it. Espionage being the act of obtaining information which is protected by the people who have it, and they don't want you to have it, so you need it. In the matter of national security, espionage probably produces maybe 5% of what is needed. Presumably, it's the 5% you can't get any other way. That's the whole premise behind it. The story I'd like to tell is the business of the Tehran rescue mission. I'm sure everyone in this room remembers the abortive attempt in early 1980 to go in and rescue the hostages being held at the American Embassy in Tehran. I had just come back from Tehran after a 3-year stint in that country, going all the way through the revolution when the Shah left and staying on past that. Having arrived back in the US, hoping never having to do anything else with Iran, the rescue, well, the hostage crisis began. And I was tapped to run CIA support for whatever that rescue mission was going to turn out to be. President Carter said to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, "You will start planning a military rescue mission." They didn't have a clue what to do. Nobody did. And for months and months and months, this tremendously difficult project was worked on, and it began with "we can't do it" to "we can do it with an extraordinary high level of risk, but we can do it." I'll sort of paraphrase what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs told the president. "We can do it because CIA has paved the way and made it possible." Let me give you some examples. You have a whole bunch of people in Delta Force, the guys who would go over the wall, kill the guards, rescue the hostages, and then get in helicopters and bring everybody out. Well, that's short and sweet. The problem is we are several thousand miles away. Helicopters don't fly several thousands of miles, and on and on and on. So we had to devise a way that we could get Delta Force from a safe haven, in this case Egypt, up against the wall of the American Embassy compound in Tehran, undetected. Undetected. Deliver 150 of America's finest fighting men to a brick wall in an enemy town. Okay. Daunting. The military, they went through everything. You couldn't drop airplane, you know, you couldn't go and drop paratroopers in to a city because how would you get out? You must have helicopters. In order to have helicopters, you've got to be able to fly them all the way in the country, 1,000 miles, and then get them out to some other location where you would join the helicopters with big fixed-wing aircraft and fly out. So what happened was the CIA went to Tehran or went to Iran and found a stretch of ground out in the desert, a road, and said, this will take big airplanes, C-130s, C-141s, those big job engine things, which can bring in fuel to gas up helicopters, which have flown in from the ocean off a naval aircraft carrier and landed one-way trip. That's all the gas they had, with big spare tanks in them. Kick out the tanks, now you've got room to fly people out of the embassy, not in. In has to be creep along, remember? So CIA found the place, and then the military, with very good reason, said, well, you think the road's fine, and it's at night, and it's out in the desert. How do we know it will take big four-engined aircraft? So CIA took Mom and Pop Airways, one airplane, stuffed it full of two or three people, a motorbike, and flew under the radar from the UAE, 1,000 miles in at 150 feet, landed, got out, went up and down the road, thumping the roadbed with his thumper machine, which says, it'll take big airplanes, and flew back out. That's not bad. We flooded the country with CIA intelligence officers who were anything but American. The foreign business community, I used to joke, increased by 2,000% every time I sent another batch in, because what they had to do was as follows, very quick summary. How do you move these fighting guys from the middle of the desert, where they have arrived by big airplanes and the helicopters have come in from the carriers, and you're going to fly the troops to a secret location not far away and hold them all night long. See, everything has to happen at night. Actually, you have to hold them all day long. So CIA rented a warehouse, huge warehouse, and into that warehouse would be brought Delta Force from the Desert One location, Desert One, by big trucks, okay? Who's going to get the trucks? CIA bought trucks in Tehran, brand new Mercedes-Benz diesels, had the bodies on those trucks built to the specifications of Delta Force in Fort Bragg in Tehran, put drivers in them, and had those trucks wheel to wheel in the desert waiting when the events at Desert One went wrong. Also, we had the embassy compound under 24-hour-a-day visual surveillance by American officers with satellite radios, which only CIA had. Nobody else had invented them yet. And on and on and on. The whole story, it was probably, I think, one of the agency's finest hours. And we did this in total secrecy. In the end, over 350 CIA staff personnel were involved in this program. All so compartmented, nobody knew what was happening. The mission was probably impossible, but we felt it would work, but we needed luck. And because my time is limited, what I have to do is say, why didn't it work? The answer is, the helicopters flew into sandstorms on the way to Tehran, which weren't supposed to be there. When the helicopters, one of them had to abort right away and landed in the desert, just right in across the water. The other ones arrived, only one of them worked right. The mission had to be aborted. No way. We could have taken Delta to the embassy. We could have put them over the wall. We could have done all of that, but then there'd be no helicopters left to extract us to get us anywhere. Had to abort the mission. Up to this point, nothing has happened, except we have a bunch of helicopters that don't work. Okay, plan, and there are lots of big airplanes on the ground. Remember, the tanker birds were there, big C-130s, full of aviation gasoline, who had just filled the helicopters up. One of those helicopters took off, and as those of you who've ever seen helicopters operate in a desert, and I'm sure some of you have, you create your own dust storm. You can see nothing. And when the pilot lifted off, he was supposed to take the aircraft up and backwards, and he took it forward into a C-130 full of aviation gasoline. Bang, bang, bang. People died, planes were burning. It was a hell of a moment. A vignette. The night before we left, when we were in Egypt, a young trooper from Delta came up to me, and CIA had built, as soon as this crisis started, an absolute detailed model of the embassy compound, each building in it. And Delta had been screaming, saying, where is each prisoner, each hostage in all those buildings? And the night before we left, CIA got that information, room by room. And after briefing them that, a young trooper walked up to me and he said, Mr. Hart, where will I put the flag? The flag. Yes, sir. I got it. I said, right. Which building are you assigned to capture? The ambassador's residence. Building stood alone near the compound wall. You know the building. He'd memorize it, go up the stairs, into the first door as you see. It's the ambassador's bedroom. Go through those doors, open them up, balcony, there's the road. Hang the flag. The next day, CBS, NBC, Pomeranian television, we'll all be filming that, and the street will be full of bodies of Iranians rushing to the rescue of their colleagues and cohorts in the embassy. And they weren't going to get across that street, trust me. Let them know. The vignette is, as the planes were burning, my bird, we were picking people up, and this kid came through the door, and it's my sergeant, and tears were streaming down his face. And he said, sir, I'm sorry about the flag. Oh, I hugged him and I wept. That's America. I gotta change horses. Afghanistan. I was chief of station Islamabad in Pakistan, and I was sent out, excuse me, in early 1980 to see if it was credible, possible to do two things. To secure the agreement of the government of Pakistan, then under martial law, President Zia-ul-Haq, to provide the support base, people, turf, everything, for us to provide covert arms to this bunch of people inside Afghanistan who it seemed weren't prepared to tolerate the Russian presence. Remember then, the Russians had occupied Afghanistan. They were supported by a communist Afghan government, and already rebellion was stirring up, but they didn't have any guns to speak of. So my job is to see, will the POX help? And are these Afghans ready to fight? Now, at this time, we were just recovering from the Carter era, where CIA was somewhere down in the basement with I don't know who, but as far down as you could get, and very timid. And I wrote the first presidential finding before I went out to Islamabad, saying for the president to sign a thing called a capital F finding, which says, CIA, I approve you're doing some covert thing. Now, this is the famous covert action, as opposed to espionage per se. For $500,000 for medical equipment, that was it. That is all the Carter White House could see to provide to a bunch of natives who were, after all, the first country since World War II to be totally openly occupied by the Soviet Union. Pretty pathetic, but it was a start. So for 5 or 6 months, and mind you, I was an Asian studies type. I had served 5 years in India. I grew up in India for some time. I spoke Urdu, sorta. I wouldn't bet my stocks on it. What stocks, right? I'd always wanted to serve in Pakistan, and you know, I was way too young for the job. But two guys, my boss who ran the Near East Division, which meant everything sort of from Ankara across to Burma, had faith in this relative kid, and the director of Central Intelligence had faith in this kid. And I was the first kid, and never mind that, first CIA station chief sent out to a job, very short job description, you will go and attempt to defeat the Soviet Empire in Afghanistan. Hey, with a blank check like that, it's great, but there's no money yet, and we don't know if the Pakistanis will help yet. And so, hey, this was wonderful. So off I went, Lawrence of Arabia, you know, with my little bag of gold, $500,000 in medical aid. I was persuaded that the Afghans would fight. Now, these are very quarrelsome, terrible in many ways people. Whatever an Afghan is, and I've never found a good definition, it's just somebody who happens to grow up in this geographic space. That's as good as you can get. They can't speak to each other if they're a mile or a valley or two away, and they're a merciless bunch. When the British invaded Afghanistan on several occasions, their first army of 8,000 or 9,000 people was destroyed to a man in 1843. One guy got out to tell the tale. One man. That was a long time ago, but we Westerners learn slowly. All Westerners. The Soviets got their dose, and guess what? It's come around to get us. Well, I was persuaded they'd fight. And we worked with the Pakistanis and got General Zia, who was an extraordinarily brave man. He got killed for his troubles. Remember, his plane went down, along with our ambassador and a lot of other people. And that was an act of deliberate sabotage. And just depends on who you want to blame for it. But when I left there 3.5 years later, our funding was well in excess, well, $350 million. But the key point was we kept it up. And in 1989, the Soviets withdrew. And not a single American life was waged in this. People used to tell me early on, are you ready to fight this to the last Afghan? In fact, the charge was that was specifically made to be by none other than Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And I said, Senator, come with me. And I took him up to a refugee camp. I did not stage this. We went to a refugee camp up on the frontier. And he has 4,000 or 5,000 Afghans all squatting on the ground. And I said, you ask them. And he did through an interpreter. And Daniel Patrick got so carried away, he'd offered them everything from aircraft carriers to nuclear weapons. Really? I said, Senator, we got to turn that down a little bit. I'm not really up to that. These were people who wanted guns. And my real response to Senator Moynihan was, you've got England 1940. Give us the guns, and we will do the job. And we gave them that. And the interesting sidelight was, here is a very dangerous moment in the Cold War, where we in the West are staring across the line of group Soviet forces, Germany, and the entire Soviet and then bloc military. In Afghanistan, we were killing their once vaunted gunships, the big Mi-24s that everyone said no one can defeat, which were the principal threat to NATO planners in Western Europe in responding to a potential Soviet invasion. These are the tank killers. We were killing one and then two out of every one produced in the Soviet Union. The Soviets never announced what their losses were. They would fly their dead out in the dark of night from Kabul because they knew we were watching, and we were. Their costs were so high that the guy who said it all was Foreign Minister Shevardnadze, remember back in the Gorbachev era? And Shevardnadze said after the Soviet Union collapsed, Afghanistan was the last nail in the Soviet coffin. And he didn't say that because he was trying to win friends and influence in the West. It is true. Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem many, many years ago about Afghanistan where he said, referring to an English soldier fighting in Afghanistan, And when you're wounded and lying on the Afghan plain, and the women come out to cut up remains, roll to your gun and blow out your brains and go to your God like a soldier. And a lot of Soviets went on to world socialism exactly that way. It was quite a trip. We have new problems. I would leave you with this thought. The whole Afghan adventure on our part was a gamble. It was totally supported by Congress, not won by Charlie Wilson. Oh, my God. You can write anything and make a movie about anything, let me tell you. I knew Charlie. Charlie and I did not like each other. Fortunately, my tour was up when he was really starting to turn up on the scene. And I've told him all of this. There's no news here. Anyway, what started out to be on the part of the president and others, to be a way to annoy the Soviets, to make them pay for going out of their turf. And they really did suppress Afghanistan. I mean, this was a Soviet vassal, do what we want, and the tales of how they took over down, they're wonderful stories. But it grew from that to the liberation of a country. Now, the fact is that immediately as that was done, there was a change in the White House, and the new regime turned their back entirely on Afghanistan, could care less, and at the same time turned their backs on the Pakistanis because they had been working on and had just developed a nuclear weapon, which indeed we reported on in CIA. And once every 6 months, I would be summoned down to see the president of Pakistan, who would say, Mr. Hart, how dare you provide Washington with this report I've just read in the New York Times, true, got to the Times, about how we are building nuclear weapons. I mean, it was a charade. And I would say, sir, I would never say that. That done, we'd go on to other business. But he was punished. And if you're a Pakistani, trust me, you'd work up a nuclear bomb because you're looking across a border at India, who has one, many. Turned their backs on Pakistan, put them on the bigoted list, we won't talk to them, and guess what we got? We got all the stuff that's happened since in Reed Al-Qaeda and Taliban and all of that stuff, because instead of harnessing the United Nations and driving into a war-torn but now free of Soviets sort of country and trying to help them build, we all walked away. And of course, Europe won't take up the slack. What? So I'm afraid that's what it boils down to. And what did we get? We reaped the whirlwind. And now here we are out there again. And it's a tough thing because, you know, there is no truth about how to behave. There is no truth. What we try to do desperately in the intelligence business, in the human thing, where you're talking to people, you know, human intelligence involves a lot of things, and it's very hard to do. And I want to tell you right now that what always surprised me about my service, and I come from the clandestine service of the CIA, was if you join that, we all stayed in. I mean, in the old days, when you joined, this was for life. And we had retention rates after 25 years of 95%, which means you died or you were still there. This wasn't always the best thing, because we had our share of jerks. Life is life. But you had to live with disappointment. The government doesn't give you golden parachutes. You may go your entire career and never make recruit one agent whose information, when he's given it to you, is of critical importance to our republic. You can go your whole life and not be able to do that, but you can never quit. You got to keep at it. And then, while you're at it, it's the whole business of manipulating people. It's not nice to say that, but that's true. If you're going to find someone and say, would you mind giving me the secrets most dearly held by your country? Well, that's kind of a big thing. Suppose someone walked up to any of you and said, would you mind selling out the United States? We might get a little annoyed. And the people who have the secrets are a very tiny part of the population of whatever is your target. So it's hard to do. And then people who sort of or really do agree don't want to do it. So how do you wind up, take the situation of the rescue mission? We had agents in Iran, Iranians, who had reported to us before, had watched their country disintegrate, but had done their bit. Now they figured they were done. So you got to go to somebody like this and say, oh, by the way, I've got this other new red hot idea. I would like you to tumble down, go buy six of the biggest 16-wheelers Mercedes makes, establish a country, a company, you're the front for it, and in the end of this, all those trucks are going to be sitting abandoned in front of the American embassy after we've just attacked in an act of war. Oh, happy to do that. Anyway, that's awfully quick. Before we take some questions, I just want to say this. In a grateful acceptance of Secretary Eagleburger's comments, the old CIA tried its best. We were pretty stupid sometimes, and we just couldn't do some things. It's gone now, and I don't have any idea what's going to come up next. I can tell you this, the United States at this moment does not have an effective, functioning espionage service. I hope that gets corrected, and I particularly hope, when I say espionage, I mean for the collection of human intelligence. Technical intelligence, whether it is photography, satellite, signals intelligence, I mean, they're the most rare kind of intelligence specialties you could ever imagine. But you get down to the bottom, it's people and it's intentions. We always used to say espionage, human intelligence, the absolute bottom line on it is intentions. We don't care if the Soviet, well, we do care, but it doesn't matter so much the Soviet Union has 935,000 tanks, blah, 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 all the way down the line. The question is, do they intend to use them? That's what human intelligence is about. I'd pause now, and I'd be happy to take some questions.
I've asked Howard to take a seat during the question and answer time. He's still carrying about 11 pounds of lead and other metals around in his insides. He sets off alarms at every airport he enters. We had dinner one night last December, and Howard and his wife, Jeannie, were telling us stories, and I thought that one of the most important things we could do at the Miller Center is to bring Howard in to talk about the role that human intelligence has played in some of the major events, political events, of the last two or three decades. And so we're delighted to have you here today. I'm going to move to the back of the room and invite those who have questions to meet me in the back, and we'll do as many questions as we can. But I'd like to open with this, Howard. Could you connect your personal experience and tell us exactly what it was you did once you arrived on the ground in Afghanistan? And how did you recruit people, and how did you come up with the plans to supply those who were trying to resist the Soviets? How does this work? In Steve Call's great book, Ghost Wars, there's a lot of ink, a lot of attention given to how you organized it. And I think it would be great if you could share with the group here exactly what it was that you did to organize the resistance to the Soviets.
Okay, I'll give it a shot. I was particularly lucky, actually, in responding to that problem, that need. My earliest years were in World War II in a Japanese internment camp in the Philippines with my family. And after we spent the whole war there, and after we were liberated, we returned to the Philippines eventually, and I grew up from about the age 9 or until I went off to boarding school, maybe 14, along with my peer group, many of our family members had been in the guerrilla movement up in the hills. Americans who had not refused to surrender, had gone up into the mountains and waged the most effective guerrilla war against an Axis nation anywhere in World War II. And in fact, whole islands in the Philippines belonged to the guerrillas. And I listened to the stories from these guys as a young, I'm a young kid, my ears are all open, and I just thought it was wonderful. And what they taught me, I didn't realize I was being taught anything, what they taught me was a lot of the things that you need to know, you need to have to successfully exist as a guerrilla force up against a modern military. I didn't realize it, but it's true. I've often thought that it would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, for a classically trained American military officer to wage such a war effectively because he'd been trained wrong. It's also very difficult to combat such a guerrilla war if you're not one. And we've seen that lots. Best intentions, willpower, everything else. Hard to do. So I'd also spent a lot of time in South Asia with CIA and before that. And so when I went out there, and I was something of a very amateur historian, as I still am, of particularly the British Indian era, where the Brits had to deal with the Afghans and lots of other things in that neighborhood. So I was very familiar with how this all had worked over the past several thousand years, but basically the preceding couple hundred. One of the first things I did is I checked out of the CIA library the memoirs of maybe 25 senior British Army officers, or British Indian Army officers, who'd served on the frontier, and I read their memoirs. I know all about these Mohmans and, these boom-booms. Well, I didn't know much, but I knew enough. And in fact, they're very simple people. They love to fight. They hate everybody else except who's in your tribe. They're moderately religious, but only moderately. They love to fight. They'll never let you see their women, and they love to fight. All you had to do was arm them and point them in the general direction of somebody else to fight with. Okay. The Pakistanis, and frankly, that was about right. I'll tell you a very interesting thing. Tribal living on the frontier, even then, your life's ambition was to have a rifle. You had to have one. If you didn't have one, you weren't a man yet. So for 100 years, they would get their rifles by killing British soldiers or British Indian soldiers and getting their rifles. We did provide a few rifles. I mean, my first big buy was to put 400,000 obsolete British rifles into Afghanistan. We weren't playing. We were not playing. 8,000 heavy machine guns. We controlled the air because the Russians and the Afghans would not fly down low enough to be any good for their side, be effective. And way up there in the sky, the hell with them. They can't hit anything. And when I told that to President Zia the night I went in to say, could we please go buy Chinese communist serviced air missiles? Only CIA could do this. We were buying Polish missiles. We were buying, Czechoslovakian rifles. We were having a great time. Not a single piece of American hardware went in there on my watch. It's kind of silly, but it made me feel good. It was a policy matter. I found that I could tell whether the war, if enthusiasm for the war was continuing by one simple expedient. I would go up to one of the villages where they made copies of weapons, rifles, and they made some very good copies. Here's a little guy in a mud hut using a piece of railroad track stolen from the friendly railway, melting it down and producing a copy of a British, 19th or 20th century bolt-action rifle or a Kalashnikov, and then they just sold them. And if the price of those rifles or the new ones that were turning up mysteriously remained the same or went up, guess what? Is that a good measure of an active support for a war? Betcham, Red Rider. So I would take monthly samples. What are guns going for on the frontier? Price was steady or going up? There's still a market. Have another 2,000 rifles. George?
Sir, thank you for a very interesting talk. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about your experiences working with the Pakistani Inner Services Intelligence Agency and be willing to share any thoughts you might have on our contemporary, shall we say, difficulties with the ISI.
Wow. Here we go. Inner Services Intelligence Pakistan is a creature of many, many heads and tails and a very difficult bunch. Interestingly enough, we still want to go back to Pakistan, right? Okay. There's not a lot of great thinking that goes behind policy in Pakistan. Never has been, particularly. It's a country bedeviled by the most incredible problems. And forward strategic thinking is one of them. ISI has always been a creature of whoever the president is, the president of Pakistan. And for all too long, that's been a military guy. On the other hand, the military is the only people who can even begin to run Pakistan with any semblance of order. And everybody knows that. And so today's president will sooner or later be replaced by somebody in the army again. Now, ISI, in my day, ISI had to be carefully manipulated. If they were not properly manipulated, you got big trouble. You could not always keep them on the right track. My line to them was they favored, the head of that service, favored arming the big religious leaders up on the frontier. And I told him, wrong bet. He continued doing it, but because we were doing our job on the human intelligence side, we were watching that unilaterally. Which I knew what he was doing without his telling me. As long as it was a dull roar, that's okay. Makes him feel all right. But he gets out of hand, you got to stop that. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the biggest fluff-ups that were after me, and when I left Pakistan in 84, that was it. I didn't ask another question. I went on to other jobs. It's finished. I'd had the best job in the world. I got other good jobs that I loved, but I didn't ask anymore. And I'll never forget the crowning. It gave me a laugh because one day when the Soviet Union announced it was withdrawing, Gene and I were overseas in Germany, but we came back and there was a formal ceremony or informal ceremony at CIA headquarters with the likes of Charlie Wilson where they were celebrating this great victory over the Soviets in Afghanistan, and they forgot to invite me. And I was sitting two floors up. In a way, that's just fine because from the little scraps I'd heard, I think I wanted to distance myself a bit. ISI, like everyone, Secretary Eagleburger will tell you, allies must be manipulated. Enemies must be manipulated. It's just exactly as all of you do at your day-to-day things. I don't know if it's your kids or your bankers or the guy next door. Life is that way. ISI is a creature of a very torn-up country. Is that good enough for a quick and dirty? Sir.
Thank you for your talk. Can you expand, you touched upon this a bit, but can you expand your thoughts as to why we don't currently have a successful espionage service?
Yeah. I want to qualify this by saying I've been out for some time. It's almost 20 years, I guess. It's been a while. And I left when I was 50 because I could tell we were changing administrations. We'd already started getting a lot of flack from Congress, which is just absolutely ridiculous. And so I haven't been present for a lot of it. But of course, the people I left behind were telling me for years, and now they're all gone too. Let's just say it's done. And it's done by dreadful interference, I think malign, from the executive branch, and dreadful interference, and definitely malign from the Congress, particularly the House. It has driven out career officers or did, they're all gone now. The young people who are coming in now do not come in with the idea of CIA as a career. We treated it fundamentally as this is a commitment. I guess the closest parallel is you went into the United States military through one of the academies, that was going to be your life. In CIA, that was going to be our life. That is not the case. Young people coming in anymore, I am told reliably, don't share the ethic of we're not in this to make money. They're coming in to get a chop in their passport through life when they want to go to work for Wall Street. All too often. A great many restrictions have been laid out. A great many, for example, in my day, and it had been for decades, the chief of station was the senior intelligence man in a country. He was it. And he worked for the ambassador. And that chief of station kept the ambassador fully apprised. And if he didn't, the ambassador would can him, as Secretary Eagleburger did more than once. But the ambassador and the chief of station should have, and very often were, the two guys in country who were really in position to do something. But the CIA guy owed it to his ambassador to make sure he knew what was going on, and everybody was obliged to tell him. I mean, if the military was operating in some country, they had to tell you. Now, I don't know who's in charge. Nobody knows who's in charge. And you can't have more than one intelligence guy in a country, even if he's a friendly, quote unquote, friendly intelligence guy, American. They don't talk to each other, never will, never should. So we have terrible troubles with recruitment. We have desperate troubles with the organization. We have undefined missions. There's just been a new issuance from the White House, the new truth about who does what in the intelligence community. And Gene brought it home the other day. It's unclassified. I guess you get it on the web. I haven't been able to read it all yet, but I do know that this whole business of having a director of national intelligence, I thought once upon a time that was a great idea until they crossed 2,500 people on the staff of the director of national intelligence. What? And who are they? Well, last week I was working for the Boston police. Now I'm a big dog in the director of national intelligence. Thank you very much. I always used to say, and this is the truth, if you hired a young man or woman to go into CIA's clandestine service, you trained them for 2 years in formal training, at least 2 years, and I'm not including language, then you sent them out, then you put them in on a desk in Washington for 1 or 2 years to learn how it worked at the headquarters in Washington side and got some feel for the complexity of the interagency thing, life in the US government, foreign affairs community writ large, or small, depending, because you're very young. Then you go out on your first year, your first assignment for 2 or 3 years, and that's when they watch you really hard. And if you don't cut it, they politely sack you because you signed a piece of paper saying, yes, I agree to go. But in that, now we're already at 6 years, aren't we? And you haven't really become a journeyman at anything yet. After 5 years in the field, I felt that's when I knew my way around, plus the training, plus the time in Washington. At 10 years, I was useful. At 15, I should really be able to pull my weight. And at 20, I was confident that I could probably deal with most things they threw my way. And that's how we grew up. You can't grow any faster. You don't go to the School of Intelligence and Espionage. The skills you need, you have to learn. And if you don't have them inherently, you will never learn them. And that doesn't begin to answer your question, but trust me, it's all going in the wrong way. And dear Lord, I mean, I feel, obviously, as a citizen, we ought to have a pretty good intelligence service, and I'm referring specifically to the human intelligence, the espionage business, and we do not.
Thank you for this presentation and your service to our country.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to turn back to Iran in the 70s, a very stable, pro-Western country under a man who was made to be evil, I think, by the American media. There were also advisors to President Carter that Khomeini was a good man, Ramsey Clark and Andy Young and others. I would be very interested in what the role of the CIA was during that very troubled time, because I think the loss of Iran as a pro-Western country is one of the most signal events of our lifetime.
No one was more surprised at the ability of Khomeini and his surrogates, which means all those people of the lower or merchant class in Iran who prevailed in throwing the Shah out. No one was more surprised at that having happened than the Khomeini people and the people who pulled it off. Trust me. It was the surprise of all their lifetimes. They never dreamt they could be so successful. They never understood how deep down in the Iranian psyche the perceived problems with the Shah's regime were. That's another way of addressing the fact that the Shah became megalomaniac towards the end. I mean, here's a guy, I mean, he really did. He thought he communed with God. One of our most terrible failures in the last 18 months leading up to the revolution, mind you, when I got there, I did not want to go to Iran. And in fact, when I'd been serving down in the Persian Gulf, and I got so told, we want you to go to Iran. And I said, do I have no friends? I mean, what have I done wrong? Because I'd never met anyone who could stand being in Iran. Well, I went to Iran. The depth of animosity towards the Shah, meaning these rascals who are in power, blah, 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 was all exacerbated by the fact that the Shah demanded and received the most incredible servility from everyone who worked for him. I mean, you could not sit in a conversation in Tehran, it just astounded me, at a cocktail party and talk about the Shah except by, say, His Imperial Majesty, comma, who played tennis yesterday. What? The whole mouthful? We got down and we were saying him, His Imperial Majesty, and her. Her was 10 times smarter than him. But what we didn't find out was he was desperately ill. He managed to get himself up to a palace, or several palaces he had up on the Caspian Sea, and he virtually disappeared. We didn't have agents who could tell us that, because the job of the ambassador, we had an absolutely brilliant ambassador, Bill Sullivan, who right along with Larry Eagleburger represents that generation of our pro-consular foreign service titans, and very few of them. He couldn't get any guidance from Washington except Jimmy Carter, to whom there were no bad people. I mean, I truly believe that was Jimmy's view of the world. Only the hostage crisis persuaded him there might be a few. And mind you, he'd sent a guy over to run CIA pretty much with the express orders is tear it down. He stopped us recruiting people for 4 years. Our new case officer, Bloodstraith, we didn't recruit anybody new, just internally. Just a small item. Iran was a shambles. We also had in Washington, and we could see it in the CIA analytical side, people who did not believe that the Shah could ever be threatened internally. And I was a new boy on the block because I'd never served there before. We weren't particularly well endowed with human sources in Tehran because, frankly, our agency and government intention had shifted to other places for a long time. But the Washington analytical establishment, who could tell you down to the 93rd generation, the relatives of the Shah, who did all this stuff, it was totally irrelevant. I'd say, I don't care. What about this? And they didn't know the answer. And I ran afoul of, I made a mistake. I wrote a piece of paper, as I recall, sort of in October, November of 78, when the thing was still boiling, but it was still, the pot hadn't jumped off, the lid hadn't jumped off the pot yet. And I wrote it as you're entitled to do, which is from me to the Washington analysts, saying, this is worse than you guys think, it's terrible. And my chief of station refused to release it, to send it out. Now, I should have gone to him and said, I insist, which we're entitled to do under very rare circumstances, but I shrugged and I said, okay. He had just come to Iran for the first time after 22 years of very good service in the Far East.
And he didn't want that negative word to go out. And in fact, what happened is I sent word back by, I was in charge of the part of the station that was recruiting agents in Iran. That was my job. I sent word back by TD Wire that send out your most senior analyst who would like to take a boondoggle and come to Tehran for a week or so. Love to talk to him. We got a guy, very nice man. And fortunately, my mistake going back to that letter again was not forcing the issue. I should have. Anyway, so this guy turns up, and absolutely fortunately, the day he came in and was standing in my office, and I'm sort of hitting him with very gently with this, I think that's, and I had the officers who worked for me in the room, and we were all sort of talking at this guy. We had a demonstration outside. Ooh, lovely. 200 or 300 otherwise unemployed Iranians stormed, not stormed the embassy, but came down to death to the United States, burning flags, doing all those good things. Now, we hadn't seen this in many years, and this was the very first one. And he regarded it as kind of the end of the world. He lived in McLean, Virginia. Ooh, this was a nothing demonstration, but it was a demonstration. And he went back, and we began to notice a little more interest. But then, we had very good intelligence. The problem was, now in retrospect, the very good intelligence was intelligence from people, Iranians, who thought they were managing the Khomeini revolution. They were the Western-trained intelligentsia who had it worked out. They would ride the crest of the common man with Khomeini as a figurehead, and they would create a small d democratic Iran. And those people are either dead or out of the country, and that all happened within 8 months. Again, no one was more surprised than they were. Iran was a toughie.
Now, staying with Iran for a moment in the current situation, do you have an opinion? Can you enlighten us on what the political realities are today in Iran and what the quality of human intelligence we have coming from that population?
I can't address what the quality of our intelligence on Iran is. I simply don't know. I would like to lay a doomsday assessment. Iraq, I guess, we're going to leave. I guess. So in no time at all, I guess, we're out of Iraq. Now, I hope everybody understands that that's going to mean that we have at least one big chunk of Iraq that is going to be absolutely subordinate to and owned by Iran. You can figure out where Iran stands in life by simply reading the newspapers. Hostile, enemy, vitriolic, needs us to be an embassy because they need the foreign devil in order to forget the minor problems at home. Now, in Afghanistan, so you've got Iraq, large chunk of it is going to be under Iran and doing what it says, and Iran will presumably, in fairly short time, all I know is what I read in newspapers, may have nuclear weapons. Even one will do, guys, just one. If it goes bang and it's nuclear, bad times. And then you have Afghanistan. Now, we have less than 40,000 troops in Afghanistan today, and when you add in a few thousand Brits and Canadians, who are the only NATO allies in harm's way there, where the rest of them sort of guard airports and don't get in harm's way on purpose, the Soviet Union, every day I got up and I looked at a Soviet Union keeping a maximum force level in Afghanistan of 120,000 troops. 120,000 was their absolute maximum. That's all I had to fight. We only have 40,000. That's not enough. And if you're going to win in Afghanistan, you got to have a whole lot more people, or you got to make, well, of course, you got to make a decision. Are we going to stay in Afghanistan? But if you don't stay in Afghanistan, I give you that half of Iran, at least, presuming the Kurds get away with not being occupied, half of Iraq, all of Iran, and Afghanistan again, and we have a Pakistan which is no more stable. Pakistan is stable? It's grim.
Hi. Do you think that it's possible to bring stability in Afghanistan, period?
Ever?
Ever.
Yes. Ever is a long time. Right? Ever? I'm not trying to be cute. It's a very difficult task. There will be no Ahmed Thomas Jefferson Khan ride in and take over and teach them small-d democracy and all the rest of that. No. But if a patient, thoughtful, well, reasonably well-financed, and intelligent multinational force group moves into Afghanistan, understanding that they've got 20 to 25 years there to try to get some sense built up, some concept of stability, some concept of peace. It's a very hard place to work. To be an Afghan is very difficult. And, you know, as I said earlier, not even being funny, I mean, it's exactly as though you took all of East and Western Europe, put them all together and said, you're all one country, get along. Right. It's a terrible problem. Can it be done? I think so. Will it be done by what we're now doing? Absolutely not. If we were serious about making a meaningful United States effort in Afghanistan, we would have to quadruple our troop strength. And I say that again with some confidence because I fought it from the other side. So yeah, maybe. Sir.
I was very impressed a year or so ago with the book, Three Cups of Tea, out of which has evolved the Central Asia Institute, which has a purpose of educating young people in the mountainous regions, particularly girls. The idea being that if you educate a girl, you've educated three generations, as opposed to educating a boy. I'm wondering if we can seriously and realistically consider that activity, privately funded activity, as a positive factor of hope for the future of the mountainous regions of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
I would say, in Afghanistan, if it's given an opportunity to work, yes, it can do a lot. And the same thing in Pakistan. It's breathtakingly ambitious. It must be done. And I think it could be, but it all depends on the background. I mean, is it peace or war? I remember I took Gene to Afghanistan or Pakistan 5 or 6 years ago, look up old haunts, and she was fascinated because you never see a woman. They're all in the huts. I mean, you do not see women in the frontier, period. And yet, you know, they're 50% of all the people around. And so it's a great undertaking. Everything helps. Afghans are not stupid people at all. They are super bright. So there's a possibility that it can be done. But as I say, no one, you cannot have a harvest of good things without putting a lot in it. And there is no way today that we can either prevail in Iraq or in Afghanistan with current force levels. I mean, it's just out of the question.
I'd like very much to give Secretary Eagleburger the opportunity not only to have the first word, but also to have the last word.
I mean, the only thing out of all of this that I'd like to comment on is this dilemma that the United States has when you put yourself in debt to or partnership with a dictator, whether it's the Shah or whomever. And that works for a while, and then as time goes on, this dictator or whatever collapses, and we are all of a sudden out of it, and we get blamed back here for having lived with this dictator. The dilemma is that it is easy enough to criticize our using Musharraf, for example, but it also works for a while. And at a time when you're trying to deal with issues that are important to us, and security reasons that are outside anything to do with his domestic issues. And yes, it is true, we're working with a dictator. Now he goes, we get blamed for all of this, and the question is, if at some point we realize he's gonna go, your Shah example,
where the hell do you go to get off him and onto somebody else? You don't know how to do that. Nobody can figure that one out. And my only point here is, please understand that on occasion, we don't have much of a choice but to live with this dictator, work with him on occasion, and well, more than on occasion, but realizing as well that we're taking on a burden which we're going to pay for later on, perhaps. Look, I spent enough time in Yugoslavia with a dictator named Tito to recognize, however, that as soon as he was gone, you've seen it since. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you do in a case like that? The point is there isn't much of a choice available to you. So as everybody then criticizes us, the CIA or the U.S. government, whatever, for living with this guy and working with him, please understand there are oftentimes either no choice or no choice you can find, or if you don't work with him, the situation that you're trying to deal with outside the domestic issues of that country but having to do with our security won't be taken care of.
Absolutely. Please join me in thanking Secretary Eagleburger and Howard.
Thank you all very much.